encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of The Fringe Fledglings. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined today by Polly Questel. It has been 2 weeks since we last recorded, and a lot has happened in that time. We are going to keep things.
It's been like a season.
Yeah.
Like, there's way too much has happened.
Yeah. You know, there were some reasons we didn't really feel like recording last week.
That's not true. That's on you. Yeah, I was busy, but I still wanted to carve out time. I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah. There are
a lot of stories only kept piling up.
We're going to try and keep things organized, orderly. So in chronological order, we're going to start with the loss to Arsenal at the Emirates. Manchester United losing 3-1 in the Premier League just before the international break. Was 1-1 for a good bit, and then Arsenal, you know, nicked two goals at the end. Arsenal, you know, not necessarily maybe as in control of the game as some Arsenal fans would indicate on Twitter, but Manchester United certainly not able to do the good counterattacky stuff you would expect them to do against a team that's going to hold the possession over them. And
Well, wait a minute. Like, were Arsenal in control? Were Arsenal not in control of the game, or were Manchester, like, if Manchester United were in control of the game, then how are they doing the counterattacky stuff?
What do you mean? Connect those thoughts. Say what you mean to say.
you are insinuating that Arsenal fans said that they were in control of the game, in which case, and they dominated the possession, etc., which ultimately they did. I think at times it was a little not as dominant. But if that was the case, if Arsenal did have all the possession, then United should have been able. If you're saying that Arsenal did not dominate the game,
right,
you're going to highlight how at a lot of junctures they did not have the majority of the possession, then right, yeah, United weren't going to be able to counterattack because they had the ball.
Yeah. I think that the first like 25 minutes of this match, what was the minute Rashford scored? Was it 27?
Yeah.
Like, pretty much the entire time up through then, it looked like Arsenal were going to win in the way that they should have won last January, which was, you know, express how they were the better team, control in the midfield, not allow Manchester United to get through them, and exploit the weaknesses that we've seen from Manchester United's team so far this season, which was, you know, the midfield opening up like an interstate highway and failing to regularly get forward and produce chances. Now, Manchester United only had two shots on target the entire game. But I would say after it became 1-1, the game very much settled into a more of you know, there was a bit of fisticuffs for the rest of the first half. And then the second half was a lot of neither team really able to do a whole lot until stoppage time, because Garnacho scores the goal that is eventually disallowed. And then Arsenal push for the winner. They get it. And then they get the third goal on the breakaway as United are desperately looking for an equalizer.
Yeah. I thought Arsenal were pathetic in this game. Absolutely pathetic. Because I thought exactly what you just said. If they wanted to thoroughly beat us the way they should have at the Emirates last year, they could have. It was there for the taking. They didn't try. It is mind-boggling how many times United come across teams that just are like, we're not really interested in exploiting weaknesses or trying against you. The first 25 minutes, it was a whole lot of... Give them credit. United got the blueprint for how to beat a team like this when they beat City 2-1 at Old Trafford in January. And we said, go out, and we said 2 weeks later, go out to the Emirates, do the same thing, and you'll have success. And they very much did not. They were like, nah, we're going to press, we're going to run, and Arsenal just whoop right through you constantly. And we didn't see that those tactics again until kind of the FA Cup final against Manchester City. So the fact that Erik ten Hag, was it because he was playing with all those changes and injuries? Maybe. I don't know. It was the smart way to play, though. said, you know what? We're not going to press you crazily. We're not going to do all these things. Like United's, their PPDA is like very, their passes per defensive action is a very aggressive. The first three matches, 7.4, 8.6, 8.9, 24.9 against Arsenal. They were very much, we're not going to press you. And it seemed like they wanted to open up those lanes for counterattacks and everything. But Arsenal were like, nah, you're not going to do that because we're also just not going to have the ball. And Arsenal freely let United have the ball. And there's this really false sense of United did something here because especially in the first half, they had so much possession and Andre Onana was so involved and they were passing. Arsenal let United pass the ball around the back as much as they wanted. Arsenal were not worried about it at all. They were just like, you go ahead and do that because you're not going to do anything. And
I would say it looked like they were, it's like if there was going to be a trigger press opportunity, it was when Onana had the ball. They let the defenders kind of do whatever. I don't think they were worried about the defenders passing the ball. There were times when they definitely tried to force a mistake from Onana.
United could not go forward. They had all these touches. 14% of them came in the attacking third. They took more touches in the defensive third, a larger percentage than like ever before. It was very, and just go back and watch the first half. It is, they passed around the back, then they moved it to midfield. And then as soon as they did that, an Arsenal player would not try to win the ball back, pressure you, but mark you. And it was right backwards, right back to the center backs, right back to Onana. And it was like that the whole game. And everybody would say, oh, they didn't let Arsenal press us. Like, get out of here. Again, here are the numbers for Arsenal. They averaged their pass per defensive action was a 6.2 over the first three games. Very aggressive. They were at an 18.4 in this game. That only happens for two reasons. One of which is, oh, you move the ball so well, so quickly that Arsenal were trying to press you, but you were getting it away and getting it out of trouble very quickly so that they couldn't make any defensive actions on you because you moved it so quickly. The thing is, if you did that, the only way to do that is to actually go through them and move up the field. And United were not moving up the field. So that was not happening. The other way it could be so much higher is if Arsenal just chose not to press. And that's exactly what they did. They just stood there waiting and United kept trying to find those avenues for Rashford and Arsenal were sitting on it. They weren't moving forward. They were letting Onana carry the ball out of the box. And then they played compact at the middle, but they weren't going to allow those balls over the top to Rashford. And they one time.
They did a lot to the other side of the wing, which, you know, we'll talk more about later.
Well, Antony was open the entire game and like nobody wanted to pass him, which says a lot about where we haven't seen United freeze a player out like that since Scott McTominay was playing and they would just openly not pass to him. They finally get one. And every time they did get something through, like you could see how Arsenal were defending Antony and Rashford. They would drop two guys onto him. One of which was like marking you straight up. The other one was there to be like, you are not cutting it back on your strong foot. United get a turnover. They make a Christian Eriksen with a beautiful ball to Rashford and they finally get him in the channel. And it's a colossal mistake from Ben White because his job is don't let Rashford put it on his right foot. And Rashford does. And he's able to get that shot and score. And what do Arsenal do? They're literally like, that was a fun 30 seconds. Hope you enjoyed it because bing, 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 boom. Right in that, and I was like, ah, okay, there it is. And now they're going to do that again and again. Like, they're
not going to play with their
3-1 lead. They're going to get a 3-1 lead. Maybe they'll push for a fourth, but that's it. And Arsenal just did it. And it was like the effort that it took to do that was so nothing. And they sat around for the entire second half, just basically being like, we're just not going to let you do anything. And it was like, this is a good strategy if you have the lead. Let United be inept. But you don't have the lead. You need to go out there and win. And they finally, in the 80th minute, someone said to me, like, all right, you'll see them. They're going to start pushing forward for a goal. now in the last 10 minutes, which I think you're leaving it a little bit too late. Though granted, you know, you do have 20 minutes these days when the 80th minute comes around. And it took them like 2 seconds to get that Bukayo Saka chance. And when they started doing that is when United had those chances the other way. Rashford got a few. He had a chance to set up Hoyland. And then
Hoyland could have won a penalty.
Well, we could talk about that too.
But we probably should not dive into VAR. I don't think we have the time.
It's not a VAR thing. If they give that as a penalty, 100% it's a penalty. But if they didn't give it, like, that's VAR. You're not supposed to re-referee the game. Hoyland initiated the contact. He is pulled down. Like, again, if they give the penalty, like, you can't argue with that. I think ultimately, given what Lisandro Martinez does, you, in the long term, if you say that's not a penalty and you stay consistent on that, United will win more there than they lose on them. But all those chances came once Arsenal finally started to knock on the door. They also United started to move the ball up the field when Harry Maguire came into the game. He was the only defender that passed the ball forward. And then Johnny Evans comes into the game and reminds everybody, like, this is why we got rid of me, because I am absolutely terrible. And Arsenal get a late goal, and then they essentially that third goal is basically like when you pull your goalie in hockey. I don't really count it. They lost this game 2-1. They threw everybody forward. It was concerning that, like, once Arsenal went up 2-1, United couldn't have any possession whatsoever. A lot of concerning things about this, but, like, by no means a lot of people being like, I remember last year where people were like, oh, they played Arsenal really tough at the Emirates and they could have won that. And I was like, no, they got killed, and they were lucky that they managed to have it 2-2.
I mean, Rashford is good for a hero ball goal. But
yes,
you need more.
He's also good to score. He's also good for an away goal against the top 16. Like, he's very good at doing that. And last year, people were saying, like, oh, it was a good job. And I was like, no, they got killed. It was a justified result. They were lucky to be in it this late. As soon as the final whistle blew, suddenly everyone acknowledged last year they got killed at the Emirates. And they're like, this was much better. And I was like, yeah, but they only had half a game plan. Ten Hag's game plan of, like, we're not going to let Arsenal really mount any attacks, because Arsenal did struggle to do that because United weren't pressing them. So they couldn't go through United's midfield like a knife through warm butter. But there was no plan as to how are you going to get a goal if you can't counterattack. And also, that's what made no sense. Like, you're holding on to the ball in the final third. All of your chances came off counterattacks. So, like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to build up and move it forward through your midfield to your attackers, because you couldn't do that at all? Or are you trying to hit them on the counter? If you're trying to hit them on the counter, just give the ball back to Arsenal.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up, because I think our view of this game is more similar than it seemed with the early introduction.
I had to talk to Suede. I had a long conversation with Suede on
your weekly counseling session
last Wednesday. Yeah, you know, it's Suede's supposed to talk you off the hill, and I was like, everybody's saying this was a great performance and we're on the cusp of greatness, which people have been saying for 4 games now, and we haven't looked good in any of them. And
that's not even to mention the not on the field things that have happened,
right? And like, we lost the two, you know, all the same problems that were there last year are still there. And we played two teams that should be in a relegation battle, and we were the better team for a half of one of them when they opted not to play. And when they had 10 men and said, we need to score another goal over the last 20 minutes, they were the better team. So I don't know. I went to Suede. I'm like, I'm being gaslit, right? Like, tell me I'm the one missing something here, that, like, everybody's saying that we're on the cusp of greatness and I'm missing it. And Suede was like, nah, this is bad. Like, we're in trouble. And I was like, you're supposed to. And Suede is the big Ten Hag fan, and he's the one that watched Ten Hag at Ajax and everything. And he was just like, this is nothing like it. And he said.
And, like, why would it be? You know?
Well, Ten Hag has also said that. He said, I didn't play the same way at Ajax as I did at the team before that, and I'm not trying to play the same way at United that I played at Ajax. But everybody seems to have that in there. You know what the Arsenal match looked like? It looked like he was like, I'm going to try to do what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did, but not as good. It just looked like he was like, that worked against big teams. I'm going to try to, and like, that was basically exactly when Pochettino was at PSG. I forgot who he beat in the Champions League. Was it Real Madrid, or was it, it might've been Bayern Munich, or might've been Manchester City. But like, he got some win against someone.
Liverpool in the group stage, I think.
Liverpool.
Yeah.
And it was like identical to like what Solskjaer had just done like the previous weekend or something. It looked like that's what he wanted to do, but he was like, but he doesn't know how to coach it as well.
Yeah. Maybe Solskjaer as second half manager really would be a benefit.
Second half manager or just away game manager.
Yeah.
Like,
we go undefeated.
Don't fall behind. You know, like he could win away from home, which Erik ten Hag has not been able to do. I'm like, just talking with Sweden, he was just like, this is the problem. And he's like, I don't really know if he's going to fix it. And he was like,
the problem too is like, there's this expectation that, I mean, we could talk a little bit about Sofyan Amrabat coming into midfield. That's going to supposedly calm things down and set tempo, because that's the sort of player he's supposed to be. You know, we have no evidence he's going to be able to carry that sort of impact. But also, like, that makes it three players with Højlund, Amrabat, and probably Kobbie Mainoo, just based on, you know,
where everybody's like, you need to fix
four
it.
Games where are we're just relying on players to come in and fix these problems eventually. Like, this Amrabat, who's, you know, the highest level he's played is Serie A. He had a really good World Cup. Very different setup to what he's going to be expected to do at Manchester United from both his role in the Morocco team and his role in Fiorentina. Kobbie Mainoo has played in, 15 Premier League minutes? I mean, he had a good preseason.
Played 90 in the League Cup?
Yeah. But like, you know, stepping in as Casemiro understudy and apparent, you know, heir apparent is difficult. And we don't know how that's going to, you know, affect him, or, you know, how the rest of the midfield problems are going to affect him when it comes to competitive play. And then Rasmus Højlund is, you know, like, he had a really promising cameo. That was probably the most interesting part of this Manchester United game in retrospect, was he looks like a player who could do something right away. He looks sharp coming off of, you know, a back injury that had us worried, but he's a 20-year-old striker. You know, he's not going to solve all of our problems.
I'm very excited to watch Rasmus Højlund. Yeah. I think he's going to be so much fun. I don't really care. He may only score 9 goals this year. I'm very excited to watch.
My worry is that, like,
another issue is like he's got that back injury.
Yeah.
He's got that back injury, and can he play all the time? And, you know, Anthony Martial can't really do anything. And yeah, but like, let's, one of the issues is Casemiro being, remember last year being like, I can fix this. I fix this in 10 minutes, whatever it was. Tell them I'll fix it. Creating that sort of hero complex, like, oh, you just need the right player in there to do it. I do remember not too long ago where like Paul Pogba would get hurt and suddenly the team would look like crap and everybody would be like, yeah, well, a good coach would be able to compensate for losing his star player and make it work. So my question is, why do you need one player to come in and save everything? Shouldn't the coach be doing that? Shouldn't the coach have a system that doesn't completely collapse if you don't have the one guy? That seems to be an issue. Another issue. Again, let's toss Rasmus Højlund out of this equation because they did not really have a striker at all last year. So can't compare that. What are we fixing? We're fixing a midfield. We signed Casemiro last year. We signed Christian Eriksen last year. And a year later, you need to fix that, and you're relying on Kobbie Mainoo and Amrabat. All right, so maybe Kobbie Mainoo. He's young. But if you're forget about that. Erik ten Hag signed those two guys last year. And the right wing that he signed hasn't been great either. Before we even get to, you know, everything else on the pitch has not been great. So who's to say that Amrabat is the answer here? Who's to say that the next guy that, you know, like, this is what, you know, on deadline day, everybody's going and being like, this is the guy United should be going for. They got to sign him. And I'm like, you know, every fan were like, they absolutely got to sign Christian Eriksen. They absolutely have to sign. Every signing that we've made was like, yes, go. This is the right guy for us. And then the people release all these threads about, oh, this is what he does and where he's going to fit into the team and the numbers and the graphs and everything. And then most of them don't work. So why are we assuming that this next one is going to work? And this is not on Ten Hag. This is on 60% of transfers fail. This is on Ten Hag because United are giving him too much power. But in general, it's in everything. Like, we should never be like, oh, this signing is going to fix everything, because most of these things fail. And Ten Hag is at the driver's seat of these things. He's been given a lot of power in this setup, and he should not have been. And that goes on to the goes overhead of like, somebody should have stepped in here and established a power structure and a way to run the club that makes sense. But obviously, and that's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, look, Polly, are you saying that we should have expected that Ed Woodward being replaced by more Glazer stooges would have just led to another person in charge doing whatever his managers say?
I think that there is room to actually put in a... It is not... Like, what's not happening is the Glazers are not sitting there and being like, we want our CEO to take charge of everything and do whatever the manager says. The Glazers are just putting in a CEO and being like, run the football club. And
make
you,
us money.
You, yeah.
Hit these numbers.
There's no like, you go out there and do it all and be the businessman, but also put the football players on the pitch. Ed Woodward just wanted to do that. And when Richard Arnold took over, he looked like, hey, I'm going to put this structure in place of like, we've got John Murtaugh, we got Darren Fletcher. Like, those are the guys. And those guys went for Erik ten Hag, and maybe they were not up front being, you know, it's on Richard Arnold to go to Erik ten Hag and be like, this is the structure here. And they are the, you know, in terms of like recruitment and transfers and signing, they're the ones, you answer to them. Your job is to coach the team. You work with them, but they get the final say. And we don't know. Maybe Erik ten Hag said, I'm not working for you. If that's the case, you know, maybe that was the, or whatever it is. These guys have bent to Erik ten Hag a lot, and that's a problem because he is not good at this, and nor should he be. He's a coach. He's not a scout.
All right, before we go on to the other matches, we are going to talk about the personnel issue that has emerged at right wing. So after the match, Erik ten Hag was asked why Jadon Sancho wasn't included. And he said, you know, gave the training answer, you know, did not train well this week, so he wasn't included in the squad. And then Jadon Sancho released a notes app post on Instagram saying basically, you know, challenging Erik ten Hag's answer, saying that that wasn't the case, that he trained well this week and he's tired of being scapegoated. That led to a whole mix of discussion about, you know, stories coming out about Jadon Sancho's work ethic, personality things, which none of them really seemed damning. Most of the examples used just came down to, you know, this guy experiences anxiety.
This guy gets moody.
Yeah.
But it was like, they were trying to paint the thing about it was they were trying to paint a picture.
Yes.
And
it was juxtaposed to, or sorry, you can.
Well, I mean, yeah. It was juxtaposed against manager said this. Manager should be the all in charge guy. And I read some funny tweet that was basically like, English people like this because of, like, you know, like the monarchy is so ingrained in them that like they want to have that one all powerful person. And I'm like, that's trans onto your football club of like, it's the manager show and we don't challenge the manager. What he says goes. They were trying to paint a picture. And like, yeah, they were grasping at straws to do it, but like that didn't matter because everybody was buying it.
Yeah. And then all of that was going on at the same time as, I believe it was Sunday or Monday, some
Monday, because they were like, if Sancho held off a day.
Right. So allegations that were made against Antony back in May have become official in Brazil. A criminal investigation has opened up against him over allegations that he abused his former partner. So there were some photographs that were posted of his former partner's injuries. There's, you know, detailed reports of specific incidents, one of which the former partner alleges that Manchester United team doctors attended to her at a team hotel.
Was it a team doctor, or they provided a doctor?
Yeah, well, that, I think that's the dispute, is that she was saying she was under the impression that it was a team doctor, whereas he called the club to get a doctor and they arranged for another doctor. And the club is...
I just want to make sure we're getting the facts.
Getting involved at this point to basically deny that they had any role in covering up that incident, as well as, you know, participating in that incident. It's very messy. And the Jadon Sancho thing was honestly more of a distraction to that than it was, in my opinion.
That's what I said was about the club wants that Jadon Sancho thing in the news.
Yeah.
Because it's distracting you from the fact that it's coming out of like, hey, they covered up some domestic abuse, which I can't say things on the podcast, but like, yeah.
I mean that is the allegation, is that the club were involved in some way in covering this up. That there was
put it this way, you know how in like
the club has denied legal...
right. Put it this way though, like, you know how in legal shows when they say, when they're like looking for something and they go, oh, you know, if that person did it once, they've probably done it multiple times. That's, you know, they've probably done it before.
Yeah.
That's what we'll say here.
I mean, look, Johnny Evans in 2008 was accused of rape in an incident that occurred at a Manchester United team Christmas party. You know, there were incidences before. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo had a case in 2005 that went away. Ryan Giggs has had stories kind of buried, you know, like, if we're going to talk about, you know, any sort of reckoning Manchester United has to face in terms of, you know, combating this culture, I mean, there's examples that go way back.
It starts at the top. It's like, it starts at the top. Like, and the problem is, it's not even that, like, yes. Well, the problem is that they think they're invincible, and the bigger problem is they acted the way they did. Is not that they like tried to cover it up. Why did they try to cover it up? Because they've done it before. And it's not about, and don't for a second think that they are the only team that does this. It's they cover it up because a lot of times they get away with it. And it's only when it comes out where then they have to like take their distance and handle it properly. And they couldn't even do that. They released a statement that said nothing. They literally just released it and be like, we're aware. And it's like 3 weeks ago, you botched this entire, you had a very similar situation 3 weeks ago. And you basically wrote the book on how not to handle it. And
they're starting the process over entirely.
3 weeks later, it comes up again. And they basically picked up that book and read it as if this is how we should handle it. And it the rod is from the top. It's like I said, Richard Arnold needs to resign. He's the CEO. And so does everybody else. But I said, I don't trust anybody else to resign. So Richard Arnold needs to go and fire everybody. And then he can resign. Because they need to restart everything. And on top of that, like, I think... Then Antony goes out and does this interview. They finally did come to the right, reasonable thing and say, hey, he ain't going to play for a while.
And I do think it
and then he does this interview, which was mind-bogglingly dumb.
I think it's meaningful that like those interviews happened. And then shortly after those interviews were made public, the club was like, yeah, he's going to step away from the team.
I read a thread written by a lawyer who was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. He said he has now admitted to like grabbing her by the wrist. And they're like, basically for a battery charge, I'm paraphrasing here. If I get something wrong, I'm not a lawyer and I'm doing this off memory, but for a battery charge, they basically need to prove there was like the physical altercation, contact and altercation, and that it was damaging or hurtful or whatever. And they're like, he just admitted to the physical part. They don't have to prove that anymore. All they have to do is prove that it was like damaging and or caused pain or something. They're like, he just did half the work for them. They're like, how did his lawyers allow him to do this interview? I get he's trying to win the court of public opinion. Maybe. I don't know. But like, how did the club allow him to do it? Either way, it becomes a whole mess. And now you go back to Jadon Sancho. What were your thoughts on the Jadon Sancho thing?
On his post or
just the, yeah, in general, like, let's go back to like,
I mean, look, this is
like Monday and be like, how are you feeling about this?
Last month,
without the newspaper reports, without the newspaper, yeah, just yeah, between Sancho, Ten Hag.
Last Monday, I was preparing myself for a week of what we eventually got, which was that story being used as a distraction for Antony. I think he did himself no favors in posting that, obviously. Because at Manchester United, especially, a player is not going to win that sort of battle, especially after 2 years of basically everything being set up narratively for Jadon Sancho to be the next, you know, big Man United transfer bust. You know, I obviously we can't speak to training or, you know, the quality of Jadon Sancho's training. I think it's obvious that there has been trust issues between him and Erik ten Hag over, you know, how reliable he can be in meaningful games. I think he, you know, he had a few decent performances in the second half of last season. My biggest worry is that the club is going to continue to sort of weaponize the brief, you know, spell of a couple of months where Jadon Sancho was sent away from the team to train on his own, and had this understanding with Erik ten Hag that, you know, this was for mental health reasons as well as, you know, getting his mind right and back and focused on football. Because like mental health awareness is a really big thing now, but it's the awareness that is a big deal. It's not, you know, methods for actually helping players or helping people or, you know, setting up institutions of assistance and security nets for preventing players falling off and spiraling. That being said, I think him taking the post down today is indicative of everyone involved realizing that this is a we're entering crisis mode in that position. And obviously Jadon Sancho wants to play. I think, you know, whether he gets that chance or not, I'm still not sure. At Manchester United, there could just be a, look, we need you for now, but we'll let you go in January on loan to Dortmund. And we'll, you know, we'll spot 2/3 of your wages or whatever.
Interesting.
I still don't know if there's a way back for him, even if he plays well.
A way back for him with who?
With Erik ten Hag.
Yeah, there is. When Erik ten Hag, that's pretty simple. You play well. You play well, you help me win, you're going to play. There's, you said, all right, so here's what you said. You said is, you can't, what'd you say? You can't, players can't do this at Manchester United.
At Manchester
there's
United,
no way back for him.
There, yes, you can't win that sort of battle.
Yeah, you can't win that sort of battle. Correct.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in 2023, you can. You can't win it with the fans, but here's the thing about the fans: once they don't like you, they're never going to like you. And that it doesn't matter how many good performances you have. Like Paul Pogba put the team on his back 1 year and was the only player doing things. And as soon as he had a bad game, we needed you to carry us for 50 games and you only carried us for 45. As you know, once they are off you and they'll get off you for any reason. And this is, you know, a couple of days ago, I tweeted like, you know, maybe it's not that we're cursed. Maybe it's just bad. Maybe this is karma coming back to the club on it. And people are like, what? Karma for what? For winning so much before? And I was like, no, like the fact that like we don't know how to handle a domestic violence case, that we try to cover that up. The fact like the fan base is terrible. The fan base is like, who cares about the domestic violence? They can kick ball well. Put him on the pitch, or he doesn't kick ball well. Let's bomb his house. That was done by our own fans. So like, yeah, I remember 2 years ago, me being like, yeah, sometimes, you know, our fan base deserves all the bad. The fans will turn on you for anything. So yeah, he's never going to win the fans back. But look at the way that this team started the season. This is year two of Erik ten Hag. They've spent God only knows how much money. They are hoping that this on loan midfielder, this 20, as you said, the on loan midfielder, the 20-year-old striker and the 18-year-old midfielder save them from after spending like 400 million. There's a very good chance, like unless those guys do it, there's a very good chance that Jadon Sancho outlives Erik ten Hag at Manchester United. And that's the thing is you can win it because in 2023, it's almost impossible to move him. Is Jose Mourinho could have been like, we're getting rid of Paul Pogba. Guess what? No one's buying him. No one's taking those wages. No one's doing that. Remember, the club was not willing to move on from Ronaldo without like a fee or anything until he went after the Glazers. So until Jadon Sancho, so they spent 77 million on this player. They have so much financially invested for him. They are not going to take a loss on that money. That's why I'm not 100% sure that they would eat the bill for him to go to Borussia Dortmund. If Borussia Dortmund called and said, we want to take Jadon Sancho on loan and we'll pay all of his salary, then yes, the club will probably do that for the wage relief and be like, look, you're not involved right now, but also maybe you come back and maybe you help us next year.
But his entire salary is like a third of Dortmund's current wage bill.
There you go. So who's taking him? Who's taking him? So if Jadon Sancho feels like he's been scapegoated, then you make sure that you get every dime that the club owes you. So if Erik ten Hag says goodbye, you're done, we're selling you next summer, you go, all right, well, Brighton are the team that want me and they can only pay 1/10 of my wages. So you guys better make sure that you're covering the other 90%. And the club may not be down for that. And they may be actually, no, we don't agree to that deal with Brighton. So there's a very good chance that Jadon Sancho outlasts Erik ten Hag. So I think in terms of like your ability at the club, you can win that. Because again, like Erik ten Hag can be like, look, you're done. I'm selling you. And the player has all the power in the world to be like, no, you're not. Which Harry Maguire did this summer. Scott McTominay did that this summer. Donny van de Beek did that this summer. Not much you could do. In terms of what happened, I think it's really important to understand something. We, and that is not the we, that is Colin and I, that is everyone here, everyone listening, everyone in the media, basically everybody who is not Erik ten Hag or Jadon Sancho and their immediate close circles, maybe a few assistant coaches, everyone, no one knows what actually happened. We know maybe 1% of it. But the fact is, Erik ten Hag came out and said it's a training thing. He didn't train well. Jadon Sancho posted that thing like a minute later. He had that post ready to go. He knew it was coming, which means like what ten Hag kind of told him. That's what I'm going to say. Whatever disagreement, argument, or whatever happened, if Sancho said anything like, how are you going to explain my absence? He'll just be like, I'll say that you weren't training well. And maybe it was a training thing. Perhaps it was. There's room for disagreement there. Sancho might have thought he trained well this week, and ten Hag might have thought you did not train up to standards. But did he let him know that? Did he let him know that on Tuesday and be like, Jadon, your performance levels are slipping and I need you to be better? And Sancho even then could have been like, sure, or what? I thought I did great today. But anyway, that's where his head's at. So at least I know. Or was it, there wasn't any communication. And then on Thursday, he was like, you're not traveling with the squad. You didn't perform this week in training. We don't know. What we do know is Jadon Sancho said, let me read you the exact quote. I'm pulling it up, sorry. I've conducted myself in training very well this week. Again, matter of opinion. You and coach could disagree on that. His next thing, I believe there are other reasons for this matter that I won't go into. Right there, that tells us there's something else going on. There is something else at play here. And now, not saying Sancho is right. Sancho could say, I believe that I'm being punished because I parked in the coach's parking spot. And because of that, he dropped me. And in fact, it's like, yeah, you did that. But Ten Hag was like, don't do it again. But actually, I'm dropping you because you're not trained. You didn't train well. It's not saying Sancho is correct or that Ten Hag is wrong. It is saying there is definitely something else going on. And that Erik Ten Hag does not have as much control over the squad as we want to believe.
Or he parked in Sir Alex Ferguson's parking spot.
It could have been anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's definitely something else going on. And yeah, then the players were off this week. They came back in today. The international players will probably come back in tomorrow. So I would take everybody's back in Carrington today, the non-international ones. And suddenly that tweet comes down, which pretty much tells you they finally had their meeting and spoke about it. And it's up to...
There's probably a little bit of, we don't need this right now.
Right. Of like, let's move past this. Take this down. But like, do I expect him to start on Saturday? Absolutely not.
I mean, not would I be shocked but like, if he's do you think he'll even be in the squad for... Let's like Brighton, I don't think he'll be in the squad probably, you know.
Who else are you putting in the squad? The team's decimated by injuries. But like, I could see him being back in there.
But like,
I don't think he will, but I don't think he will, but it would not shock me. It just seemed like there's a meeting of, yeah, so this happened a week after the transfer window shut. You're not going anywhere. We need a right winger. We got to make this. Also, the club is very invested in you. And yeah, like you don't necessarily have to go anywhere.
I'm curious how this is all handled because the fixtures do start coming thick and fast again.
They do.
Obviously, if there's an effort to like ease him back into the team, you've got, you know, Burnley and then the League Cup, you know, after the big Champions League fixture. But, you know, this is going back to midweek games. And this is, you know, we haven't really had the chance to talk about this yet, but the Champions League group is, you know, not straightforward. And they play the most difficult opponent week one.
You got to get a result in that game.
Yeah.
Mostly because you can't beat top eight teams away from home. So, like, go into Bayern Munich and get a result and prove something there. But also, like, if you can't beat Bayern Munich, like, how are you going to get a... If you can't beat Bayern Munich, you're not finishing top of the group. And then if you do advance... you're going to draw a team that did finish top of the group. Like, how do you expect to get past the quarterfinals if you can't beat a team like Bayern Munich?
Magic.
I don't even think Bayern Munich's that good this year. So, you need a very lucky draw if you're gonna do that. But if you can't beat like a not so good Bayern Munich team, that's a problem. But one more thing I want to say about Sancho is, I'll be the first to say he's been very underwhelming on the pitch, but he still does a lot of things. And they can use that.
Like to me, and this is another thing about, like, you know, you talked about being gaslit earlier by like the rest of the fan base, but it's like, I get that he's not living up to the hype, but like, he's not been especially bad when he plays either.
He was historically good.
Yeah.
He was historically good at Borussia Dortmund. It's like some of the numbers he put up there, like only three other players do that. It's like Neymar and Messi were two of the other three.
Right.
and he was historically good. He's also like not that kind of winger, but people, you know, a lot of people didn't watch him at Borussia Dortmund. And when they did, they saw him going on these nice, fun, dribbly runs and stuff. He's very good in tight spaces, but no, he's not your take on a man and beat him kind of guy. And that's sort of what Manchester United fans want in their wingers. Beckham, Giggs, young Ronaldo, like those guys could take on a man, they could beat a man. He has also never gotten that run in the team where like it's unclear of like what the plan was because they changed the plan so quickly. Like it seems like the plan was go Martial, Rashford, Sancho. And within two, and his first right away, he had the illness. So like he couldn't play at the beginning. He came on against Southampton with Greenwood down the middle and Pogba on the left, and they cooked for like 15 minutes. And then they took Fred off and he stopped and United couldn't get the ball anymore. And then a week later, they signed Ronaldo and the dynamics of everything changed because it's all different, but also, and it's understandable. You have a hard first season. It's a dysfunctional team and whatnot. And then last year, like his big extended is running the team early on in the season. He never seems to get the chance to play with like players that would fit him. Like his run early on, he's playing with Rashford at striker. Rashford's not, especially early in the season, Rashford not really a number nine. He was more of a number nine later in the season, but even more of. He needs an overlapping fullback. And at the beginning of the season, Tara Malacia was playing. And Malacia is not really that guy either. And when he got to play like with Martial, he played well. And then at the end of the season, when people were like, it looks like he's turning a corner, it's like, well, he's playing with Luke Shaw and he's playing with Martial. And it's suddenly starting to kind of make sense. Do you want to put him on the right side with, you know, we've never just seen him. They changed the plan so quickly that it hurt, but nobody gets the ball in the box as often as Jadon Sancho does for United. And that's kind of an important thing now that you have Rasmus Højlund. Like now that you actually have a striker, that's a pretty good thing to have. There's also, he's never like taken over a game with the ball at his feet. But United are often a better side when he's in there. And like it's noticeable when he comes off the bench, where it's especially when he came on against Nottingham Forest, like as the false nine, it was like, wow, there's so much space there. Like all of a sudden Rashford and Antony are finding space because like Sancho's making runs and he's creating space for people. And he's done that in the past where it's like, we look different when Sancho comes on because he's doing things off the ball, even if he's not tearing it up on the ball, but it's a noticeable difference from what there was. And it's easier to see that when you come on as a sub versus when you start, because at the beginning of the game, there's no benchmark. So you just see what the team looks like and that sets your benchmark. And then you go and say, well, when Sancho gets the ball, he's not doing anything with it. So let's try a different attacker. And look, I'll be the first to say, like, they do need more out of him as an attacker. You're going to play as the right wing or the left wing for Manchester United. They need you to get some output. So when you are not doing that, like, yeah, they need more from you. But there would be games where it's like, he's doing all those things. Then the ball comes to him and he's not doing anything. So, okay, let's try a different attacker. You take him off. And then suddenly that new attacker isn't even getting the ball because the dynamic of the team changed. And things that were being done aren't being done anymore. And like when you start the game that way, you don't find out about that until it's too late. Whereas when you come off the bench, it's like, oh, yeah, look at how much better we're playing now since that guy came on. So, like, I think they can gain a lot by having Jadon Sancho in the team. But there's no doubt about it. Like, Jadon Sancho needs to step up and give more if he gets another chance. And they kind of have to give him another chance because they don't have the personnel to avoid it.
Right. Unless, like, you know, Pulisic, who seems likely to start. Yeah, maybe, I guess.
I don't think Pulisic starts.
Against Brighton?
Oh, God, no. Who else? Certainly not against Brighton. Oh.
They just threw Rashford, right?
It's going to, oh, like, oh, so yes, no. It could be that. That's what it's gonna. It's either gonna be Garnacho and on the left and Rashford on the right, or it's going to be like Eriksen's gonna. If Amrabat is ready to go, you could see Christian Eriksen pushed up. There's an off chance like maybe McTominay comes in and plays as the number 10, but like most likely it'll be Bruno on the right, and then like when Mount comes back, it'll be one of Bruno or Mount. I would put Mount on the right wing and leave Bruno centrally, but he did this in preseason and he put Bruno on the right. He seems to love Bruno on the right wing.
Yeah.
I think that's what's gonna happen. The fact that he doesn't put Pelestri in until there's like 7 minutes left, like even when they're down, he doesn't put Pelestri on until the very late of the very late, means he don't trust Pelestri to play any defense, which means he ain't starting.
Can we just do what like Real Madrid does with Jude Bellingham, but like put Bruno Fernandes at the center of that and just have like Rashford and Hoyland?
Do we have anybody good enough, as good as Jude Bellingham?
I mean, no. But Bruno Fernandes in that sort of role centrally. I guess centrally is the key word when it comes to what I want to say.
The thing is that Bruno's going to go where the ball is. The thing about Bruno is if you can't get him the ball, he's going to go and find the ball and he'll get it and he'll make things happen. But he's making things happen from deeper. He's getting it forward. And now you don't have Bruno Fernandes forward, which is where you need him.
Yeah.
And when you don't, and they don't have Luke Shaw right now, and Diogo Dalot against Arsenal couldn't pass forward to save his life. It's not build up if you're not going anywhere. You're not building up to anything. That's just stale possession. Remember that in the Van Gaal years. Possession for the sake of possession means nothing. That was what they did against Arsenal. They got to figure out a way to get the ball forward. And they got to figure out a way to do that without Bruno Fernandes having to drop deep. And then have a secondary creator there. Which, yeah, like, I think that this team could really use Facundo Pelestri. Because he's the only guy that will like hold with and not be trying to cut inside. And I think that could be very useful with a Hoyland and a Rashford on the left wing. Whereas like Rashford, Garnacho, Antony, all these left footers are just trying to cut inside and clog up the middle. And he wants Juan Bissaka to stay narrow and create from that half space. It's like, who's your overlapper that's getting your width that allows you to get it to like get it deep and then make your pass to like your half space guy and maybe then provide a cutback to your striker or something. Like, I think Pelestri could really offer them something. So could Sancho on the right wing. I don't think either of them are going to start on the right wing. Yeah. And United are, and they're in for a difficult spell right now.
Yeah. So they play on Saturday. We'll get an episode. We'll try to get back to doing Mondays. The last two Mondays we had Labor Day,
and they play.
And then play, this Monday,
the only team to beat them at Old Trafford last year.
Yeah, so yeah. Interested how that goes.
With and now they've got Varane injured. Lisandro Martinez might be injured.
We still don't know if Mount and Amrabat are going to be available because Amrabat had to pull out of the Morocco squad for injury. And
they said that was precautionary. Mount, they said, like Bayern Munich.
Okay. Yeah.
Lisandro Martinez didn't play for Argentina, but he was there in training. Lisandro Martinez. Ooh. They said he picked up a knock right in the spot where he got surgery against just a few months ago, 2 days before the Arsenal match. He shouldn't have been on the field if it was an issue.
Yeah.
If that was an issue, he should not have even been on the field. And yeah, 60 minutes in, it's the same thing. Like, what are you doing? You trying to make sure that he gets surgery again? Because I guarantee you, if Lisandro Martinez is going to start on Saturday, and it's like he's probably not fully fit.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think Evan Ferguson is going to do to Johnny Evans if it comes to
Johnny Evans doesn't start? Johnny Evans is playing. She said it was illness, is why Lindelof had to come off. But yeah, Lindelof does get bullied. And like Lindelof is Lindelof.
Yeah.
He's been the same defender for 5 years now, which is good. Not as good as everybody has made him out to be because he's not Harry Maguire, and not as bad as everybody made him out to be 3 years ago because he wasn't Harry Maguire.
But Pauly, he's hot.
Yeah, well, that does help.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us on this long and extensive episode of the Fergie Fledglings. We will try to be back next Monday and make that more our usual time. We are also going to try and do hopefully some crossover content with Bavarian Football Works, because we don't usually get to collaborate with the non-Premier League SB Nation sites, and that sounds fun. We, of course, being the Fergie Fledglings, who are not the Busby Bay podcast.
Right.
Right. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.